Good day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now, here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Welcome back, everybody. This is another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, secret societies, and the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. As you know, the Guardians of the Holy Grail show was created by me to clear up many of the popular misconceptions that have been floating around mainstream media regarding the secret societies and Holy Grail mysteries and the bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. I'm hoping that through this show I can set the record straight with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of the Initiatic Societies. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and wisdom of the original Knights Templar, which over the centuries has either been lost or ignored. You can learn more about our Gnostic Templar organization and sign up on our mailing list and receive our monthly e-news. You can do this by visiting our website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. During today's show, if you have any questions for myself or for our guest, feel free to call our toll-free number, which is 866-472-5795. Now, today, before we start our show, I'd like to give a brief synopsis about the World Congress of Initiatic Societies that I was just at in Macerata, Italy. This took place on Saturday, April 17th. And there was a full hall of people that came to this, at least 200 or more people. And as speakers, there was myself and Sir Ian Sinclair, and there was also about 12 grandmasters and heads of other initiatic traditions. And each of them gave a short talk. I'd have to say at the end of the day, we kind of all realized that we were basically all on the same page. We're all very happy that we had come together again after more than 200 years, and we want to keep this going. We want to come back together with future conferences and continue working towards a world alliance and certain reforms that we feel need to occur within the initiatic organizations. We're already talking about having a conference in Florence, Italy, for next April, and then good possibility of having one in Edinburgh, Scotland, next July 2011. If you're interested in these conferences and you want to keep up with what we're doing, keep checking our website, our Gnostic Templar website, for updates. I'd also like to mention the France tour, which myself and my friend Nancy Safford are leading in September, between September 20th to the 30th. We're leading a tour to France, southern France, and northern Spain. It's called the Black Madonna, Mary Magdalene, and Holy Grail Mysteries Pilgrimage. Both myself and Nancy are Knight Templars, and she's also a high priestess of the Magdalene Mysteries. We have chosen this time period to lead a tour to southern France and northern Spain because both of us feel as though the goddess is calling us. As you know, there's a major revival of the goddess tradition around the planet, and especially where her tradition and her mysteries have been powerful and strong in the past, such as the Languedoc region of southern France. And we feel like now is a time that the goddess is tradition is being revived, and the goddess is sharing her mysteries and her secrets once again. And we feel like that the time we've chosen in September could be a time when some secrets will be revealed. Because for one thing, there's a powerful full moon that will be occurring while we're there, and there's also, of course, the equinox, which is always very powerful. While we're there, we plan to visit Rennes-le-Château, Montségur, Sainte-Marie-de-la-Mer, Montserrat in northern Spain, many places that we feel some of these mysteries may be revealed to us. And as a lot of you know, there's a gigantic pentagram, terrestrial pentagram, throughout the Languedoc a lot of these mystery, goddess mystery rites have taken place within this pentagram. And today it's marked, each of the corners is marked by specific goddess sites, such as Rennes-le-Château and Béziers, which was a preceptory for the Knights Templar. So we hope that many of you will want to come with us. If you are interested, take a look at our itinerary for the tour. Go to this website, which is www.sacredsitesjourneys.com. And while you're there, if you're interested, you can also register for our tour. I think it's going to be quite popular, so you don't want to put it off. You don't want to hesitate, because it could fill up fast. Okay, today on today's show, we're going to be discussing a new trend. We're going to be talking about the movement of DNA tracking that is currently being used to discover the roots of certain individuals and families and clans around the world. We will be specifically discussing the DNA research that is currently underway to track the origins of the Sinclair clan of Scotland and Sinclair family around the world. Lately, many of you may have heard that the Sinclairs have been associated with the Merovingian kings of France and even the lineage from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Well, today we're going to find out exactly what the Sinclair DNA is revealing about their lineage and about their roots. Our guest today is Sean Sinclair, the owner of the Elvingar Dynasty DNA Project, which he founded to analyze Sinclair DNA in order to discover the ancient roots of his family line. Sean is also the host of the Hidden History Hour on Blog Talk Radio, which he uses as an on-air forum for this work. So greetings, Sean. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Greetings, Mark, and thank you for having me. The interesting part about all of this was I was so enthralled by listening to what you were doing. I wanted you to continue because it sounds like you have an excellent itinerary set up for your summer, and good luck with your tour in France with Ms. Stafford. That's great. That's excellent.
Thank you again for having me. I could fill up the whole show with just that, but I think that the listeners have tuned in for something else.
I'd
really like to hear about your DNA research. So tell me how you got started on this research.
Well, what we did was we took a sample through ftDNA, and that was my own sample, and we sent it in for the analysis, and it came back, and it really opened my eyes as far as cutting through paper trails and identifying particular areas or regions that we come from. And when you get into DNA, it's not always an exact science, but certainly the markers are. So what it does is it tends to open up your viewpoint and look through and sift through much more information than just going through a library in a church somewhere, hoping that you might end up with a paper trail or a marriage certificate. DNA is a little more specific than that, And through the course of looking at our own DNA in the past 5 years, we've been able to open up the Alvengar Dynasty DNA Project and analyze others who are willing participants, and to compare these markers against one another and see if they match up. Or if they do not match up, then, you know, where are the markers that don't match, and why? If we have a certain surname like the Sinclair family, you know, the proof is in the pudding. We're not all going to match up, so we have to determine where our origins come from, and really DNA does help with that as far as the analysis goes. I wanted to bring up the fact of the what the Alvengar Dynasty Project really does is it's not just specific, Mark, on one surname. It's many different surnames, because as you know, surnames weren't invented until probably much later in time than most people think, 11th, 12th century, when after the conquest in 1066 of William the Conqueror. And what they've done is they've said, okay, well, you're from this village, you're from a foreign land, where's your village? And it could have been anything from Lens to, you know, a type of individual that was named the Fleming or the Teuton. So these surnames evolved, and so it makes it much more difficult to pinpoint where the families come from if you're looking at it from a paper trail. But I think DNA has kind of bridged that gap a little bit. It's, like I said, it's not an exact science, but we are trying to get through and identify particular individuals. I think the biggest finding that we've actually had a breakthrough with, and if you wanted to discuss the Merovingian connection to the Sinclair family, then I would have to go back to Dr. Vanek's report and Dr. Koch. Vanek is one of the leading forensic scientists in Czechoslovakia. He does work for the Bavarian State Department. He has his own lab and so on and so forth. And what he's been able to do is extract ancient DNA using a specific method and then apply it to the markers that we see through various companies around the world. And one of them is FTDNA, which is the company that I went with. Family Tree, by the way, Family Tree DNA. And there was a gentleman that kind of sifted through the information, as well as my own wife, in comparing some of the markers that were extracted. They had actually been working on this site since, I think, 1997. Dr. Koch is an archaeologist. He's done a lot of other sites. He has years of experience. So he has a lot of the credentials that are needed for these sites, because sometimes people just go in and start digging and they miss a lot of the evidence that's there or presented or don't understand it. He has a very good grasp, so kudos to him and his team for doing that. And what we were able to find through Dr. Vanek's work was a comparable set of markers, excuse me, that when put against particular members of the Alvengar dynasty, they were matching up quite closely. And the reason why is all in a report that is on blog, excuse me, it's called the, by Mr. Bill Lipton, a friend of mine. He's got a great analogy on it on his blog. It's called The DNA Spread Theory, and it actually shows the graph that he took and the information that we shared with them on it, and then he built it into a nice graph, and it's all there for everyone to see. And the comparison is really quite close. And, you know, when I asked Dr. Vanek and Dr. Koch, like, you know, are you saying that these individuals were Merovingian? They answered back, absolutely. So it was really quite stunning, because here we had these graves taken from Ergolding in Bavaria, and this was an area that the Merovingian kings were expanding into. There were some other people, I believe Avars and so on and so forth, in that area as well, but the Merovingian kings were expanding, and so they had naturally would send their closest relatives to handle negotiations, We also know that during that time, the Merovingians were in contact with Constantinople. That's been proven. And some of the other individuals that were involved in the actual grave, I think there was something like six or seven bodies that were tested. They were able to determine that at least three of them were almost identical matches. So it would have been a father or a son or a nephew, you know. And what Y-DNA does is it goes through the male line, because we carry the Y and M chromosome from your mother's mitochondrial DNA. So the Y-DNA was extracted and from these individuals, and the tombs were labeled, you know, 244 A, B, C, and D. And we've found such a close relationship from these individuals. The natural question was, well, where did they come from? And from the archaeology and from the report that Dr. Koch gave, and which I stand by his work, and who am I, you know, to say anything differently, but he is adamant that these individuals were from the Merovingian court. They found particular material, swords, jewelry, things like this that were in the graves that were completely untouched. And it was due probably and most likely to their status. And if I'm a grave robber and I think I'm going to go into a Merovingian grave, knowing their history and their family, it's kind of a deterrent. But the other individuals in the grave, Mark, they were robbed. We didn't find anything on them that could identify them, at least. And so when the report came out, what we decided to do was work with Bill Lipton on this, because he does work in genetics, and he actually runs his own R1A1 group through ftDNA to help the R1A individuals identify their own genetic markers. And so he is the ringleader for the R1As. And so when we worked with Bill and said, you know, what do you think, and got a second opinion, he was surprised to see the closeness of the compared markers. And I believe the one individual from the Alvangar project, he was only, I think, one off on all of the markers that were extracted. He couldn't extract all of the alleles that we have the privy of having, because, you know, the genetic labs, you can go all the way up to 67 markers and do your deep subclad testing through them as well. But the markers that were extracted, I think he was only one off from the rest of the individuals within that grave. So it's a resounding,
so that's pretty exciting to actually find some ancient DNA that you can, you know, compare contemporary DNA with. You know, I always wonder how far back can you go where the DNA is still intact so that you can study it. Could you go back as far as the pharaohs in Egypt, for example, you know, to study their DNA?
Well,
how long does it survive?
One interesting, it actually depends on the conditions of the grave. I think that's the biggest reason why we have not extracted more DNA, and but if it's in a good a burial, you know, like a tomb or so on and so forth, your chances of extracting it are much better. And depending on the technique or lab, you might get more alleles or markers than most. So if it's in a good preserved place, you definitely will get more. And you'll get better DNA extraction. I know that Simca, when he worked with Mr. Cameron on his project, the ossuaries, to me it didn't look like they had a lot of DNA to work with, but they were able to determine certain things out of that grave. And so when they sent it to Lakehead University, which Lakehead University is one of the finest DNA labs in the entire world, they work, I believe it's a nuclear extraction technique that they use, so it's very sophisticated. And their crack team is wonderful. So there was I wanted to get back to the DNA of the pharaohs. That's an interesting point, because we were just looking at some of the markers that they tested, or some of the DNA that they tested from King Tut. One gentleman, and which we're going to be looking into more so, and actually talk with the labs and get their opinion on it, and have I will have that report from them shortly, probably within a month or so, if not sooner, and speak with the individuals myself just to verify what we're saying. But if what this other individual is saying and showing these markers on online, he's stating that the markers and the actual DNA haplo group, and a haplo is just simply where you're placed genetically from A to Z. And let's say, for example, the Western Europeans are, you know, R1A or R1B. That's generally Western European. And that's what haplos determine. So if the King Tut DNA was extracted, and if the technique was, and the markers are credible, and what he's saying is true, then the individual in King Tut's DNA, or King Tut himself's DNA, would have been R1B. And that means that that individual, King Tut, was a Western European haploid, which is pretty shocking, because my understanding is that he wasn't Western European, and this is the first I've ever heard of it. So we're going to look into it and verify it and see if we can't talk to the lab that performed the extraction technique. And I find that very interesting, because if King Tut was Western European, how did he get there? And was he and his father and so on and so forth? There was a program just on the History Channel that I watched, where they actually gave the lineage for King Tut all the way, you know, back to Imhotep III. And if that's an unbroken male line, and they do further testing on those individuals, and it all comes back, you know, relatively similar, or if not exact, then that would be a very huge, significant find in the DNA world, and for archaeology as well, because here you have a Western European who's sitting on the throne of Egypt during, I forget which particular dynasty.
Right. Well, obviously that's amazing discovery. Another discovery that seems to be pretty amazing is the one in Rennes-le-Château, which I'm sure you're familiar with it. Ben Hammett found a mummy in a cave and believes it might be that of Mary Magdalene. Apparently, from what I understand, he was able to cut loose a strand of her hair, and it was analyzed. The DNA was analyzed, and it matches, I guess, Middle Eastern DNA. So I guess my thinking is that let's just, for argument's sake, say that this really turns out to be the body of Mary Magdalene. Then you should be able to analyze that the DNA of that mummy and compare it to Sinclair DNA or any family DNA to see if perhaps they really did descend from the lineage of Jesus and Mary.
The only problem with that, Mark, would be the fact that it's a female. And mitochondrial DNA, you inherit from your mother, her mother, and her mother, and so on and so forth. The only way, and I'm not sure if they determined that it was either male or female, but I would imagine that they did. And if it were female, a better sample definitely would have been a Y-DNA sample from a male. So what I would do is I would take a look at some of the documentary evidence that we have. Certain professors out there have written several books on this, and take a look at where we can interject a little bit and say, okay, perhaps we should be looking at this particular male. Where is he buried? If we can do that and establish that and establish, you know, their actual paper trail and documents without any breaks, that's even better. But 9 times out of 10, there was lots of infidelities and so on and so forth. But if we were to trace back certain lineages, including that of the Merovingians, and we had later on the house of Valois and the Robertians and so on and so forth, could we then verify, you know, let's say two graves and have the paperwork for them and take the DNA in extraction and use, you know, a fairly credible lab? Could we then therefore verify their lineage back to Mary Magdalene? It would be very difficult to say that the mitochondrial DNA is going to show up, because it's just really, I mean, it's the best preserved. It does not break down as quickly as the Y DNA. But what we could do is through the documents say, okay, these individuals did marry into the line of Jesus and Mary, and is there any work out there that has, you know, the actual formal lineage of Jesus and his children? Yeah, there is. There is documents. There is books available to anyone and everyone. Certainly, myself, I've looked at various writings from a lot of the different authors that are out there. One in particular is Hugh Montgomery, another gentleman that I received, I believe it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago, was a gentleman by the name of Hugh Sinclair. And Hugh Sinclair, in his note that he actually wrote down and gave out, and it was formally kept in his documents. In this document, he states that Jesus and Mary were indeed married. They had children. He names them outright. And it goes back to John the Baptist, which was a little surprising. So when we're looking at certain documents like these, Hugh Montgomery, Professor Montgomery, actually put these in his this note in his book, and agreed with Dr. Hugh Sinclair. And we have to ask ourselves, well, who is Dr. Hugh Sinclair? Is he credible? Does he have any credentials? Well, he was. He was one of Britain's leading scientists in not only agriculture, but he was also on the staff of Sir Winston Churchill as the, I believe it was their nutritionist during the Second World War. Was he around the Queen? Maybe. More than likely. Did he show his work to her? That's pretty fascinating also. And thirdly, is his work reliable, and what are his sources? So when we go back and take a look through all of it, Montgomery goes in and says, this is what we've found. This is what we have from these ancient manuscripts. And this is the lineage that we believe is accurate. So then it becomes, well, who do we need to get in order to have tested? And will it work? Well, there is a place in France that has the a huge store of Merovingian kings. And someone, I won't name who, was already in there and got a sample from a Merovingian princess. But what should have happened was, if he had just turned to his left by about 5 or 6, could have had Clovis, King of France's DNA, because it was right there. And could we have retrieved other Merovingian kings to actually triangulate who they were? Did the line break at all? Are they compared to the Merovingians in Ergolding? Could we have done that? Absolutely. The Merovingians, and this was written about in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the Merovingians said and stated that they came from royal blood. You know, every dynasty is going to say that. Perhaps they were right. Perhaps they actually did come from Jesus and Mary's, one of their children, but which one? And can we prove it through DNA? So that research still has to continue, and it still has to go back right to the beginning of the fall of Jerusalem. And, you know, when we go into places like Rennes Le Château, and other researchers like Ben Hammett go in there, and they do all of this incredible research. It just makes it so much easier for the community of knowledge seekers and researchers, because there's that much more information that we have available to put this jigsaw puzzle into its place. And if we have credentials and if we have the right type of DNA and the documents, then I would hazard to say anything against it, because it is so airtight. And a lot of the scholars that are within the church, they don't agree. They never will agree. And it's that doctrine and it's that mindset that has buried the truth for so long that it makes it harder and harder for the generations to come along and research the available material, because it was either burnt or it was stolen. And you mentioned Montségur. There's a famous example of exactly what happened when people actually tried to take these lineage charts and documents and hide them. You know, the church didn't start the Albigensian Crusade and have it last in their backyard for 20 years if they weren't looking for something. And they used the guise of heresy. Well, in a way, I guess it would have been heretical to say that there was a bloodline of Jesus and Mary. But yet there is slight references to even Pope Sylvester meeting with the master's kin. So these little references, you know, you have to dig and you have to find them, because they're out there. One of the biggest, propaganda machines out there would be the church's attitude towards, you know, an unholy marriage of Jesus and Mary actually having children. It's asinine to think that he didn't have children, because according to Jewish law, if he was a man, you know, he's got to marry a woman, right? And Montgomery brings up the fact that he may have been married actually twice, not just once, but to a woman by the name of Mary of Bethania, and a Mary the Magdala, or the Magdalene. And it would have made perfect sense. And what we've kind of taken a look at through genetics is there any proof that we can say without, you know, any regret in saying it, any proof, or what's the oldest dates that we have, where can we get that from? And the Ira Golding finding was just that. It kind of solidified the Sinclair heritage back to Merivec. And in history, there was two Merivecs, Merivec the younger and Merivec the elder. Now, if you look at the lineage charts, Merivec the younger didn't have any children. It was Merivec the elder that stemmed the rest of the Merovingian, hence the name, dynasty. And further back from that, it goes up to supposedly one of the grandmothers, I believe it was, or, you know, being inseminated twice, one by a sea monster king or whatever it was, and once by, you know, his dad kind of thing. And this is where they get the god, the fish story from, and he was the king of the sea, so to speak. Anyways, it's a long story. I'm just trying to make it as quickly as I possibly can, because we'll move on to the next topic. But according to certain people, that Seambrook King was actually, the sea monster was actually a Seambrook King. So, in a roundabout way, it would have made perfect sense for those dynasties to intermarry with one another. And this goes all the way back to Atuf and Alaric, the Visigoth kings. And, you know, one married the other's sister, so on and so forth. So we have their lineage chart very, very mapped out. It's very well done. It's, nothing is airtight in history. That's one thing I've learned. So I won't say it's airtight, but as close to airtight as we possibly can. I think we've nailed the Merovingian dynasty and their origins and who they come from. And if that's the case, then, and they're relating to the Ergolding individuals in the year 670 AD, and then of course the recent comparison with that to the Sinclairs now, I think we can safely say that indeed the Sinclairs were at least relations, or if not, stemmed from the Merovingians.
Well, can you analyze the Merovingian DNA to discern what their origins were? Did they come from Palestine? Did they come from the Holy Land? Or what is their origin?
Their origins are, simply put, they were R1B, which means they are not a Middle Eastern haploid. They are a, through the Y DNA, they are Western European without a doubt. And that you can check out on Bill's blog. Everyone can see it. You just have to punch in DNA spread theory. I'll just turn my computer on just right now. It's just called simply DNA spread theory, and they can take a look at the comparisons for themselves. And what it's showing is that they are of a European descent through the male line, paternally.
Well, could that also include Troy? The common history I hear for Merovingians is that they came from, originated with Troy, and then came west.
I've also read several papers and articles on that as well. The archaeology doesn't seem to match that, and this is the reason why, because there's no archaeological evidence stating that the Trojans settled in after the fall of Troy, settled in a particular region south of the Baltic. That may be true, but I wouldn't rule it out. And I'll tell you the reason why. If the DNA goes back, let's say, 10,000 years in particular, I'll just use mine as an example. It's called F21. It's a subclade of R1B. And predominantly, we are what they would call a classic Germanic and Frisian Danish marker. And we go back 10,000 years. So is it possible that my ancestors traveled from their origins in Frisia, Germany, and that Franconian border all the way down into Mesopotamia? Let's use that as an example. Absolutely. And it's not out of this world, because those traditions that we see at the end of the Viking lifespan in the 9th century, before all of them converted into Christianity and the Viking way of life seemed to almost dissipate and disappear from the history books. Before that, you know, what were they doing? Well, it was a culmination. And if you take a look at the Viking lifestyle, they were sea people. They traded. They were merchants and mercenaries. Those traits you can trace back through large portions of the centuries to particular individuals such as the Varangian Guard, the Rus, all the way into Russia, so on and so forth. These individuals could have traveled as far south as, you know, Israel, Egypt, without question. And if you take a look at, I'll just give you an example of an individual, Rollo, and his father, or sorry, grandfather, are mentioned in Eastern Chronicles as being in the Mediterranean. So it's nothing for them to travel from all the way from, let's say, Denmark, Shetland, Orkney, all the way down through the Straits of Gibraltar. And they actually were almost decimated. Their army of 300 or 400 ships, they only came back with 129. And it shows that they had the capability of trying even the most daring moves, and that was sacking Constantinople. So I don't disagree with that, but I would say that these individuals traveled, and they had been doing this for centuries. This is what they were taught. And why is there a cuneiform language with little tiny cylinders and huge amounts of treasures in places like Sweden or Gotland, or, you know, strongholds of Vikings, and why is it that these cuneiform things were placed there? Why were they buried there with a king in particular? Well, that's pretty easy to explain, because if you take a look and just draw on the map, you know, down, they're travelers. They know all of the river systems all throughout Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And for them, I think trade brought them to certain cultures and drove them into places that were extremely well known in those times or centuries, that were hubs of trade. So these traits that they have, they still held on to for centuries afterwards. And their ships were ingenious. And the way that they built them were beautiful. These weren't barbarians, you know, stupid barbarians with clubs. These were extremely sophisticated individuals. They had a whole system of life that was taught to them by whom? Well, they had to have learned these trades and skills from someone. Probably other cultures that they mapped out or took from along the way. So it's not a far cry that these individuals would end up in foreign places such as the Middle East and, you know, becoming rulers. And if one of them became rulers of or a pharaoh, and we have their DNA as an R1B, then you have to look at the evidence. And the evidence speaks volumes.
Sean, can we talk about the Jomungar dynasty for a moment? Because apparently, through your research, you found a lot of association between Sinclair DNA and this particular dynasty, which is why you've named your project after it. So, could you explain what this dynasty is all about? Its traditions, sure, and its history.
It was first written about in the actual name Jomungar means young branch in Nord. So young branch, or like for example Yinlingit, that's another name for it. It's a conglomerate of different clans that were of Scandinavian origin, and they basically took over the Western European Empire. So they were a very powerful family, and depending on which ruler was ruling in Denmark, Norway, Sweden, they possibly came from different clans. So they would have genetically, possibly different DNA. But they were all a part of that tradition. They were all intermarried, most of them were intermarried to whoever the strongest was. So let's say, for example, the Jomungar king in Denmark, he's got a younger son, and he marries him off to a girl in Orkney, but they were cousins. It would have been nothing for the Jomungars to do that and to keep a very tight family, much like the Salian Frank and the Merovingians did. And the Jomungar dynasty is a conglomerate of not just one surname, but many different surnames, and these individuals were extremely powerful, and they ruled, like I said, the Western European Empire and parts of the Eastern as well. One individual that's on the Jomungar Dynasty DNA Project, his DNA is showing up that he comes from what we call the Ruikid Dynasty in Eastern Russia, in Russia, near Kiev. Actually, that's where his DNA came from, and we have him placed in the 8th century in southern France. Now, how is that possible? So, again, I'll revert back to Bjorn Ironside and Rollo taking individuals from Kiev and coming down through that massive Viking raiding party and the Viking war against Constantinople in the year 800 and something. And I find it amazing that you would find this individual in southern France where his family stayed. And then a few generations later, they went up, they married into the ducal house, they married a St. Clair, and they brought the girl back, and they've kept the name ever since. So this is the importance of DNA. This is the importance of the Jomungar dynasty. It's not just to focus so much on the Sinclairs, because they're only one family amongst all of them. And when we take a look at many more participants joining, and many more participants coming into the project, we get a much better database to compare and look from. And if we take a look at their documents and their documents as to whom their earliest ancestors are, then we get a bigger picture, and we can kind of draw those pieces together to form, you know, were they from this particular region, and much more data from all of that if we have more participants and good documents. And that's really the important thing, too. We can't just rely on our DNA. So the Alvangard Project is for everyone that may have an association to the Scandinavian, to the Germanic houses, to the, you know, not just the kingly line, but just Germanic families, Germanic or Scandinavian, Frisian, English, Scottish families, and the more documents that we have to support where these individuals come from, we start to see a much more clearer picture of how we kind of fall into the genetic code, as it were, and who these individuals are. And it does help the rest of us if we can say, okay, look, for an example, I'll use my gentleman that is the N1C group from Kiev. That helped us immensely when compared against the rest of the Alvangard, because we weren't necessarily looking in that particular haploid. We were looking at the R1B or S21s as kind of maybe a branch of that. And again, it showed us that there was other individuals and other families that traveled together. And the biggest ones that do travel together, I've found, are the R1A and the R1B. So if we can learn from other projects, we have much more information that we can share for future researchers or even our children. And the more information we give them, the more accurate our history will be, instead of having other people rewrite our history and tell us not to look at it. We can say for ourselves, I'm sorry, but we're going to take a look at this because of certain projects that are out there. We can use DNA, we can use documents. And that's really why we started the Alvangard Dynasty DNA Project, was to share as much information as we possibly can, not just about ourselves or just about my DNA and its markers, but other individuals and their histories as well, to try to determine, let's say, for example, I have a gentleman on there by the surname of Comerford, and he goes back to Charlemagne, and he's showing a very close genetic match with another participant. Well, he can take his documents and say, okay, you know, I'll try to find my way through it and as far back as I can go. But we do share this common ancestor somewhere along the lines, and you can kind of narrow it down a little bit more. And that's really the fun part, is when people make breakthroughs and start sharing their information. And I think that's really the importance of the Alvangard Dynasty DNA Project, was to share information.
Well, Sean, what have you found to be the origin of the Alvangard Dynasty? Because then that would be the origin of so many people that share the same DNA, right? They would all go back to wherever. Didn't it originate someplace in the Middle East or Samaria or someplace?
Well, our group in particular, some professors have stated that the Alvangards would have came up from the Sumer. And from what we're seeing, it wasn't that way, but they may have been in the Sumer and then traveled back up. But their original haploid is Western European. And we also had some information, too. A gentleman wrote to me and said, you have to take a look at this book, because the information in it is pretty interesting. And his theory was that before the Ice Age, there was a northern country or northern group of kingdoms, and then when the Ice Age happened, it forced them down south. So then if that's the case, and we start to see them fleeing the flooding, the snow, if you will, they would have ended up in other parts, but when it all went back, they went back as well. So there's different theories that we have, but we do know that the Alvangars are R1b. They're Western European haploid. They are the most populated individuals in Western Europe, which means that you know thousands of years ago, these individuals repopulated Western Europe without question. These are the individuals that did it. Maybe there were some more other haploids out there that didn't make it through that because of the expansion of these R1Bs, but they were pretty ferocious at repopulating the Earth or Western Europe where they were at. And these are the individuals, and that's where they come from, and that's their origin. And they may have traveled down south. It is definitely possible. And the more DNA that's recovered, the better our chances of finding out if they indeed, how far south they went. Some of my participants that I'm matching are near Ararat in Turkey. So, you know, did my ancestors travel further south? Quite possibly. And then, of course, you know, in perhaps even in Israel. But then again, during the centuries, Crusader Knights invaded, and maybe that's why that there's, you know, this type of DNA showing up in Israel or Egypt or which not. So we have to be very, very careful. And through the documents that we have and the research, it shows very clearly that the Alvangars are a massive Western European family.
Well, I think you might have mentioned to me that within Clan Sinclair, there has been a faction that's been somewhat opposed to this work, and so I'm wondering, why would that be? Why would they be opposed to your DNA research?
I think the biggest thing would be a difference of opinion. And simply put, our project likes to include others. I think the best thing to say about that would be if our DNA were the same as theirs, then everyone would jump on that bandwagon and say, great, we're all together. But because there is such a division, there is diversity in the Clan Sinclair DNA, we all want to be Sinclairs in origin. We all want to come from, you know, Mauger, you know, and or William the Seemly, and so on and so forth. But it just simply can't happen that way because our DNA is telling us opposite. And our DNA isn't the same. So people will get their nose out of joint if you're not related to the head guy or an earldom lineage, or there were several of them. There wasn't just one. It bounced back between different branches throughout the centuries more times than I can count. It's almost one of the most confusing bloodlines to take a look at because it did change a few different times, and people would, certain earls or barons would take on, you know, a wife or a third cousin or a fourth cousin. They would inherit the title. And then if she died or he died, they would marry someone else. So a lot of the families would have a very good variation of different DNA types. And that's just due to the fact that there's just some of them that probably came along during the Viking raids. And they were in that area. They were traveling with these individuals. Myself, if I'm going to talk about my DNA, I would say that it's definitely S21. We've proven that through ethno-ancestry. And I think because our project tends to focus more so on individuals that are S21 or variants thereof, at least anyways, it's much more specific than say, you know, a surname project. And I wish them the best of luck, but to tell you the truth, it doesn't matter in our project what your last surname is. And I think if certain individuals get their nose out of joint because they aren't S21, then I'm sorry, but the DNA doesn't lie, and our project isn't just S21. It's for everyone to take a look at and to share with that. and some of the other individuals. They want to claim that their ancestry goes back all the way to William the Conqueror or one of his cousins and so on, and then not take a look at any of the other evidence and the other lineages that are within the Sinclair DNA. That's their prerogative. But from what we're seeing and from the evidence that we're gathering on participants from the Avangard Project that are S21 and they are Sinclairs, their paper trail looks very good to a few of the more than one or two of the earldoms or the earls of Caithness. And it goes way, way back. And then from there, you'd look at their ancestry and you say, holy mackerel, they do go back to about the 9th century. And so if they're matching very closely to other individuals that have these markers, then, you know, I would imagine over 1,000 years you're going to be at least 4 to 5 markers off. That's nothing. Because every 250 years, you may mutate. You may not, but, you know, chances are your DNA might mutate. You might move away. You might, for whatever reason, markers will mutate. So for myself and the rest of the individuals that are looking at their paper trail, which leads to one of the earls, it's not so much we want to prove the earl's line or they're of that line. We just want to prove that they're from one of the lines. And they have some pretty good documentary evidence. And I think,
have you found, I'm wondering if you found that people's DNA records are a lot different than their genealogies. Have you found that?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely, without question. And I think that's the biggest tool in finding or taking the DNA test. That's a huge tool to cut through all of that paper trails and I'm this and I'm that and say, okay, let's take a look at it from a DNA perspective. And if they're coming up a Middle Eastern haplo, chances are I can't really see that they would be related to the Sinclair family. But if they're R1B, you know, that puts them in a ballpark. That puts me in a ballpark. I'm an R1B. Okay, great. So when we cut through all of those notions or myths about our family and look, some individuals have even said that William the Seemly didn't even exist. So we have to take a look at everything, and we have to do it constructively. We can't constantly tear down other people's work and say, well, this is completely wrong. We have to do it in a constructive manner. And instead of stating, like certain individuals do, they come up and they state, well, the Sinclairs aren't related to the Ducal House at all. I think if we were to take a look at it through a DNA point of view and start to get these individuals tested and these tombs tested of known individuals of known ancestry, then we can start to see a much more clear picture that perhaps it might come out as an outcome that they were right. But we have to do it in a constructive way so that we can actually say, okay, this document states that this individual was the Archbishop of Rouen and he fathered children and these were the children. Now, there's at least one St. Clair that went on crusade. We know that. There's at least one St. Clair that went over to England, if not three or four of them. We know that. So, you know, we can't just, you know, tear everything down and say, well, because you don't match this DNA type or the Avangard, you can't be related to that family. That's not what we do. Others may like to do that through their books, and that's fine. But our point of view is we need solid ground. And the more solid ground we have, I think the better off the rest of the clan will be. And in thwarting individuals that want to tear our good name down.
And well, I would really think that it would be a major deterrent for some people if their station in life is based upon their genealogy, and the DNA could potentially prove differently. I would imagine that could be a big deterrent for them getting tested.
It's a voluntary thing. It's you know, when you take your DNA, you should be interested at least, but that doesn't mean that you can't take the DNA test and be anonymous and not share your markers with anyone else. You can certainly do that as well. But I think knowing, you know, or not knowing where you come from, that should be something where you would want to find out, as any historian or genealogist would want to do. The DNA does do that, and it offers a lot more than just paper trails, because paper trails can be broken. There could be infidelities. There could be numerous things. We're seeing that all the time on the Alvengar Dynasty DNA Project. There's lots of different quirky things that happen, and we were just looking at the connection to the Carolingian family, and we're pretty shocked. I mean, here's a Carolingian descendant. He's got good documentation. He's got good paper trails, and it's backed up by a lot of different historical societies, and they're matching, which I don't understand, because I always thought that the Carolingians were the mayors of the palace, and they weren't relatives. But maybe we need to re-examine history and say maybe they were. Wouldn't that be something? So DNA can help us do all of that, and DNA does do that for a lot of people. And I think it's a great tool to use. And no one should be afraid of taking a DNA test. It's an interesting tool, and it's a lot of fun. I think certain people take the fun out of it by being too serious. But I think you should have fun with it and see where it goes. And, you know, if you're relating to the Queen of England, great. If not, oh well, you know. Many of our greatest individuals in history were poor farmers.
Well, I'd like to have some fun with it myself, Sean, and I know a lot of listeners would like to as well. So how do we go about getting tested? Can you give us some direction
here? If you'd like, you can simply just Google the Alvengar Dynasty DNA Project. That'll bring you to our page, and that will bring you right up to FTDNA's page on the Alvengar family. We have our own project website on there. You can email me directly, or you can email my wife. She's also involved in the DNA, which makes it a lot less stressful for myself. And our email addresses are on the website. You can simply contact us, and we'll send you out your kit after we've chit-chatted and got your information. And if you're serious about it, that kit will be out to you in the mail the very next day, and you'll be, I think it's 4 to 6 weeks, and you'll have your first 12 markers. And then after that, another 2 weeks for the rest of your markers. I've only taken 25 markers myself, but there's other tests that you can do, simply 37 or 67, depending on your financial situation. And you can start that right away, and it's an excellent tool, and I encourage everyone to do it.
Excellent. Well, great. And you're I know you're writing a book that should be done soon. Do you foresee when that might be out?
I'm thinking by the end of the year. There's just, you know, when you're writing, there's always something new to add in, and sometimes it's very difficult to put everything that you wanted in into the book instead of just stop writing. You know, maybe that's sometimes the best, is just to stop writing. But it should be done and finished and published by the end of the year.
Well, excellent. Well, we'll all be on pins and needles to read that now. A big thank you for coming on. I've been excited about the show myself, because I have some Sinclair ancestry myself, and I don't know, I'm a little bit worried now that it might not show up in my DNA, but I'm willing to take the risk, I guess.
Definitely.
Anyway, it was great having you on, and anyone that wants to hear more about your research can listen to your Blog Talk radio show, right? And when is that on
exactly?
Absolutely,
called the Hidden History Hour, and it's on Blog Talk Radio. You can certainly Google that. We have our site there, and they can click into the next available show. I usually do one a month on a Monday, usually Monday at noon. That's when we hold our shows, and some of the guest speakers, depends if they're from Europe or not. Time.
Great. Well, once again,
thank you for having me, Mark.
Coming on, Sean, and we'd like to talk to you again. Maybe when your book comes out, And I mean, there's just layers that we can go through with this research. So it just seems like we can talk forever on it. So definitely need to have you back on again in the near future.
Thank you very much, Mark. Have a great day. Thank you.
You too, Bye-bye. Sean. Bye. Well, next week we have another great show. We have as our guest Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. I know that many of you will recognize those names. They have been pioneers in the field of Templar research, the research around the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and the Johannite tradition, which we in our Templar organization are particularly aligned with, which is basically talks about how John the Baptist was either the Messiah or a co-Messiah, one of the Messiahs. So it's really wonderful, pure heretical wisdom and information. If you like that sort of stuff, which I do, tune in next week, same time, same place. And so in the meantime, have a wonderful week, and always remember that the Holy Grail is always right inside your own heart. Bye for now.